Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the former Apple Director of Product Marketing, Michael Gartenberg. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
It's nice to have you on the show because I've been reading your work and your analysis for a long time. It goes way back. And then there was this really cool event where you went dark, so to speak. And I want to ask you about all of that. But first, as we do in the show, I've when you read somebody and you read them for years, you kind of think like you know them. But I'm sure our guests are curious about how you came to do this thing that you're doing now. Often in our younger years, we don't necessarily plan on doing what we're doing later in life. Tell me about your early life and what you were planning to doing on doing before all of these big events in your life.
Sure. Well, you know, it was a little bit hard to think that I was going to be someone focusing on things like iOS because there was no iOS. But I got my early start. My degrees in college are in psychology, as well as speech and communications, and a minor in computer science. And, you know, back in the day, and I like to think I'm not that old, computer science meant I was probably the last generation to use things like a punch card.
Really
bore no resemblance. Just the intro class before they would let you use, you know, the Unix terminal. And the reason I wanted to do that is so I could play Star Trek. Going back to my early days, I once ran up a rather large timeshare bill, but that's another story. My master's degree was in education, and I really started out being a teacher. And I liked being a teacher. And unfortunately, I discovered...
Interesting. What were you teaching?
I was actually teaching secondary school. I was teaching history. And unfortunately, I discovered that teachers really aren't paid a lot of money, and that's a whole separate discussion. And teachers often can't afford to send their kids to the schools that they're actually teaching in. And I had always had a propensity towards technology. My father was a big gadget fan. I probably got it from him. We had like one of the first, you know, VCRs in the universe, first big screen TV, you name it, we had it. And so I kind of inherited that from him.
Was that a big influence on you, your father's technology bent?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was actually funny because there's a certain point where I think technology just got away from him. He had a certain point in his life where he was still buying the gadgets, but it was clear the technology had moved beyond him. And I was wondering that's going to hit me. But I've always had this,
that, you know, 12 o'clock midnight flash on a VCR.
Well, as we used to like to say in our family, you could ask my dad to record a TV show, and it didn't matter what you asked him to record. You were going to get an episode of Magnum PI. That's it.
Nice.
But I had this, you know, propensity to technology. We were an Apple II family early on, although we were also an Atari family and a Commodore family back in the day. As I finished graduate school and entered real life, I had a Macintosh, a 512K SE, one of the real classics. And
it's funny how when you start with an Apple II, it's a natural progression into the Mac. So many people fell into that.
Well, and I had, you know, tricked out the Apple II with all sorts of weird, you know, RAM cards and graphics boards to try and get it to do everything that was close to a Macintosh. And Apple even had a mouse that it came out the same time, roughly for the Apple IIe, with some sort of like program called Mouse Paint. And at a certain point, I was just like, this is just ridiculous. if I want to turn this thing into a Macintosh, I think it's just time to, you know, bite the bullet, spend all of my entire life savings and, you know, buy a Macintosh. And it was probably the best thing I ever bought. And, you know, I had just been doing this out of love. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine, and, you know, we were talking technology. And he said, like, why don't you do this for a living? Like, what do you mean do it for a living? He goes, this is what you love to do. He goes, you know, you wrote your thesis, your master's thesis on computers and education. Mm-hmm. Like, do you realize that you love to do this? And I'm like, yeah, but no one gets paid for doing this. He goes, are you insane?
That's the trick in our lives, is to get paid for doing our passion.
Yeah. So to me, it was sort of like, there's a Robert Frost poem, and one of the lines is, you know, to unite your avocation and vocation. For mm-hmm. me, that's just, you know, what this became. And, you know, I started at, shall we say, the very bottom. I was working with a small Judaic software vendor called Dafka, one of the oldest computer software companies and still around today. And, you know, I had joined them doing pretty much whatever needed to be done, programming, you know, applications in HyperCard.
What was it about, if I may ask, what was it about your particular background that got you that job? Was it your expertise with computers? Education background, or was it some magical combination on your resume?
Well, I had a good foundation in terms of, you know, technology and Jewish education. They were pretty much the only company doing computers and Jewish education. And I guess to say my resume was, I had been working on this program to teach Talmud with HyperCard, and I had sent it to them on spec, and they liked it so much that they were like, you know, if you want to work here, do you want a job? And because we're in Chicago, we need someone in New York, and, you know, you're going to do everything, you know, from creating applications, doing technical support, all the way through that. And I was like, yeah. And it really established a connection. I mean, I still am in touch with the founder of the company. We're still good friends. Whenever I need a you know, business reference, and sometimes it's hard to go back. People say, you know, we need a former reference. Like, I have no idea where any of my former employers are. But I know I can always go back to Alan Rosenbaum at Dafka. By the way, that's Dafka.com, D-A-V-K-A, best Jewish education software in the world. So started there, and from there I kind of moved into technical support. I had a weird skill set at the time. I knew Macs really, really well. And
were you doing things like Pascal development and things like that?
No, it was more like a lot of places had Macs in their environment for one reason or another, had no idea how to manage them. Or what to do with them. This was at a time when everyone was focusing on Windows. So I managed to pick up a couple of gigs doing tech support, ended up in a law firm. And the reason I got the job there was one of the partners decided that he wanted Macs in his department. And the reason was, in his words were, you know, my kids have them at home and they love them. We're going to have them here. And that was to the chagrin of the IT director, because he had no idea what to do with these things.
Did desktop publishing play a role in that, because he was an attorney and he wanted these beautifully printed documents with laser printers?
No, it was his kids had them and they loved them. And that's where he was going for his technical recommendations. And I guess as one of the senior partners who, you know, gets to decide these things, you can't say no. If you're the CIO, you basically say, well, yeah, I'm going to have to figure out how to create these weird Macs into a law firm that has nothing to do with Macintosh. And, you know, this is the early 90s. There was no such thing as cross-platform. I mean, you couldn't even get a cross-platform document from Microsoft Word to another version of Microsoft Word, because the file formats were entirely different. And I remember us going out to both Apple and to Microsoft, trying to get them to deal with these issues. And back in the day, they were both just sort of like, well, we'll just lie and tell them anything.
There was pitched competition in those days between the operating systems. Windows 95 had come out, and people were saying, well, we don't need Macs anymore. And
well, this was even prior to that. So we're still like in the Scully era, still in the Windows 3.1 era, and things like Lantastic.
What an awful operating system 3.1 was.
Yeah. Well,
and I've used it.
And, you know, you just try and get these things networked, and you had to have your Macs connected, trying to network to your PCs. I mean, look at this stuff now and go, wow, you know, I can't even imagine.
Had to install your own TCP stack.
That's right. Kids, ask your parents. but that's sort of how I made my career. I went from there to Philip Morris. Philip Morris at the time was Apple's second largest customer in the universe. And my
so
job
you're in this universe in orbit around Apple. I see right. It coming.
Right. So that's, you know, where we started my real professional relationship with Apple. I was their second biggest customer. And this was Apple in its probably most bizarre days, some of its most bizarre days, because Apple did not know how to deal with big business. And I was big business. I could buy 10,000 PowerBooks, you know, with the stroke of my pen. And Apple treated me as if I was buying one at a time. Whereas Microsoft, you know, would sell me 10,000 licenses for Windows. Mm-hmm. And it was just a piece of cake to deal with them. And the funny thing is, and now we're talking, you know, kind of like early mid-90s, is as we got into like the second half of the decade, turned out that Apple knowing how to sell one thing at a time turned out to be a really useful skill. And Microsoft, while it could sell 10,000 things at a time, couldn't sell one thing at a time. And that kind of hit them out. But did have a lot of fun there. And at one point I got a, probably on late 94, I got a call from a headhunter from a place called Gartner Group, as it was known at the time. And Gartner Group is the largest IT research and analysis firm. We were actually clients of theirs at Philip Morris. And I was asked to interview there to be a research director. And to be honest, I wasn't really interested. I was having a lot of fun, you know, actually doing stuff. And I, you know, talked about it to my boss and he said, you know, why don't you go interview for it? And I said, you're trying to get rid of me? He goes, no, but you know, these guys think that, you know, they're the super hot shots of the industry. Why don't you see how you stack up? I'm like, okay. I think it's the first only time I ever went to, you know, a job interview in the behest of my boss. And it was really interesting organization. And it started with a conversation with the headhunter, who interestingly enough got my name from someone at Apple, but that's a whole nother story. And, so yeah,
my connection, threads.
My connection with Apple goes deep. And that was a really interesting job process. And I don't know how they do it today, but back then I had to do, you know, pretty much a half hour phone screen with the recruiter. And that was followed up with a 45 minute conversation that was going to be taped so that the managing director could listen to it in his car and then see if it made sense to have, you know, continue from there.
Interesting.
So that led to another 3 1-hour phone interviews with various other people that I'd be working with on the team. And you kind of had to pass muster with all of those people. Then it was come in for a full day of interviews. And, you know, it was really designed to, I learned afterward, to wear you down. And then after that, you know, by the time that you had, you know, gotten down to 2 or 3 candidates, you had to come in for a group interview. The group interview process at the time was really fun. You walked in and you had 2 hours to write a research note. Usually it takes about 2 weeks to write a research note, and that's if you're pretty good. Here you had 2 hours. You could pick your topic in advance, but you couldn't bring anything into the room with you. No note cards, no papers, nothing.
No Newtons.
That's it. You had to sit down and just write this thing in 2 hours, and then you were going to go how to defend it to the rest of the people on the team, you know, group of, you know, different analysts and research directors, etc. And
what were you thinking at this point? Were you thinking, maybe I don't want to do this? Or were you thinking, boy, I'm gonna really do a good job here?
Yeah, at this point, it sort of became tenacity.
Like, yeah.
seriously, like, just who do these people think they are? And, you know, we'll see, you know, who's going to show who here. And along the way, the thing became a little bit more interesting. But the group interview process was brutal because you basically, I remember, I can even tell you, the research note was about Apple. Surprise, surprise. And it was something to the effect that Copeland, their operating system that they were working on at the time, I said was never going to ship. I said, this thing is just never going to get done. And I got about like 3 sentences into my presentation. And right off the bat, people just started interrupting you and throwing stuff at you. And basically, you know, try and rip your living heart out and putting it on the table. And later on, I learned that all of these things are sort of the weeding out process. If you're going to be an analyst, you have to take inquiry from clients. So you're going to have a lot of conversations and you have to be able to speak in depth. If you're going to get up and present in front of 10,000 people, then you better be able to present in front of 10 people who are going to be really harsh at their worst. So, you know, we did go back and forth, and it really was a grueling experience. And again, I learned afterward that people in the group interview process would break down and cry. They would curse, throw things against the wall, and storm out.
It was your PhD thesis.
And just say, I'm never doing this. So it's an interesting process. But in the end, I did get the job much, I don't want to say much to my surprise, but it was sort of like, wow. And I was like, you know, this is the whole new thing. This is like, you know, taking all the practical stuff that I've learned and applying it into whole new ways.
What
and
a cool story.
So I spoke about it with my boss and, you know, said, basically, I want to give it a shot. And he goes, look, give it a shot. He goes, if you don't like it, I'll keep your job open for 6 months. And, you know, so you get a feel for it and you have a safety net. But I did it. It was a lot of fun, tremendous amount of work. But it was going from a Fortune 500 corporate environment, you know, 9 to 5, suit and tie, to this, you know, casual, almost collegial environment that it turns out, you know, once you had passed the test, everyone was really kind of really great and warm and friendly. It was a lot of fun. Got to write about a lot of things. My core topics at the time were desktop operating systems. This was at a time when you could break these things out. You know, I was the desktop operating system guy. Person down the hall with me was the server operating system person. Someone, you know, across the way was in charge of PC desktops, and someone else dealt with just mobile devices that weighed 30 pounds or so. And we formed this PC team, and we had a lot of fun. We were a great service. We spoke at conferences pretty much all over the world. I got to cover companies like Microsoft and Apple and IBM, and kind of got to live in the center of whatever was happening at these universes. People wanted to come in and brief us and make sure we understood what was going on. So spent a lot of time dealing with vendors, a lot of time talking to clients and giving them advice based on, you know, what I would do. Spent a lot of time researching, writing. It was really a great gig. And I stayed there for about 5 years. And by the end of 99, at that point, I had become the lead analyst at Gartner, covering Apple, although no one really cared because no one wanted to cover Apple other than me. But I was also the lead covering Microsoft. I got to interview Steve Ballmer on stage at our symposium. And I was
what was he like in person?
The next thing to do. He's really a wonderful, warm human being, and that I found when I've had the chance to work with him
often
and,
the public image
and to do it on stage.
The public image of Mr. Ballmer has often been rather as a brusque person, not real deep, not real warm. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, you know, and what I found him on stage at the time was probably like a video of it somewhere floating around. I don't know if we actually took videos back in the days, but he was warm. He was gregarious. Remember, he was speaking to thousands of people in the audience who were his customers. And I remember afterward they had, you know, a little reception where, you know, it was sort of like all the other analysts who wanted to get a chance for, you know, 5 minutes of his time and, you know, toast him or whatever. And I remember he walked in the room and said, you know, guys, I would love to stick around here and talk to you. And he goes, look, you all have my business card. You know where to find me in Redmond. But I got like 10,000 of my customers out there because I want to go talk to them. Please accept my apologies. And then he went outside and just worked the crowd. And people were coming up to him with all sorts of crazy stuff. You know, my Windows 95 machine is, you know, locking up. And he would take their business card and write down the thing, go, you know what, I'll get back to you on this. I'm going to have someone on my team look at it. And he just stood there working the crowd for probably close to an hour. And it was pretty amazing. It was pretty something.
Interesting.
Pretty something wild to see.
I think we're going to have to take a break here. We want to come back after the break and talk to you about how this was just inching you into getting a job with Apple. And I want to hear how that happened. But first, we're going to take a quick 60-second break. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thanks, Kelly, very much. Michael, I want to talk to you about how you got the job with Apple. Now, everything so far you've explained is sort of like poised you for this. You were in orbit around Apple in so many ways. Let's talk about the events that led up to that, because that's always a big experience in a person's life. Were you contacted directly by Apple, or did you apply for a position? Tell us how that happened.
Well, you know, around 2002, I started working with a small research company called Jupiter Research, and the focus was on purely consumer, no longer enterprise. And this was at a time right after, I think I joined about 2 months after the iPod was introduced. I mean, so there were no smartphones, there were no camera phones, there were no color phones. This was a couple of years now after the return of Steve Jobs. Their relationship with the analyst community had changed quite a bit. This is the time when Apple started becoming secretive. And I was covering them closely. There weren't a lot of people looking at the consumer analysis side. And one of the earliest Apple execs that I met during that time period was a person named Greg Jaswick, also known as Jaws.
And we know him well.
Right. So, and that's the first time I met him. He was like, "Hi, I'm Greg Jaswick. Call me Jaws." And apparently, he says that's everyone. And, you know, he became one of the focal Apple. He had been in charge of, marketing for MacBook at the time. Then he shifted in and he took over this little project called iPod. So I had a lot of time working with him and his team, with Phil Schiller. And, you know, spent a lot of time, working with the company and covering the company. And I guess they felt, said, okay, this guy understands us. He, you know, at least from their perspective, was always a sense of, you know, he's going to be critical when he's critical. He's going to be honest when he's honest, but he's not playing, you know, a game of, you know, false equivalencies or anything else like that. So for the better part of, more than 10 years, probably closer to 15 years, I guess, I had worked very, very closely with Apple. And it was 2013, March 2013, doing a quarterly analyst call. And this is something that Apple typically does with analysts. Let's get on the phone with them every quarter and just, you know, remind them, here's how many of this we sold. Here's how many of that we sold.
Right.
You know, try and do that little bit.
We all listen to those every quarter.
Little mind meld. So these are usually the one-on-one follow-ups. So as we're finishing the call, Jaz goes, Michael, do you mind if I call you later on? Just need like 5-10 minutes of your time. And I'm like,
must have been interesting.
Yeah.
What did you think was going to happen?
But you have to understand at this point, Apple VPs don't call analysts just to schmooze. VPs don't talk to analysts unless there's two PR people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And even the PR people, I learned later, were kind of bewildered. And so I'm like, okay. And I hang up the phone. I'm going, what on earth did I do that I have totally annoyed Jaws? Like, what stupid thing did I say that was so totally incorrect about Apple? What
or maybe some very smart, shrewd questions.
That was not going through my mind. What, And I said, because, you know, Jaws is a gentleman. He is not going to dress me down on a call with other people. He's just going to call and take me out to the woodshed and tell me where I went wrong. So I'm spending the rest of the day sitting there going, I'm going through every, you know, research note that I've written for the last 2 months, every column that I've written, every tweet. And granted, there were plenty of dumb things that I said, but I couldn't think of anything that quite could bring it to this level. Things like, oh yeah, that was like, okay, that was probably a mistake, like that word was even accurate. But I don't know, like, Jaws like to call me home for this. So around 7:30 that night, I kind of remember clearly, phone rings, and you know, see, it's a 408 number and coming from Apple, and you know, pick phone, and he goes, hey Michael, it's Jaws. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, what did I do wrong? And he goes, look, I don't have a whole lot of time to talk right now, so I'm going to cut right to the chase. He goes, would you like to come out here and work with us? And I'm like, Jaws, let me figure out what exactly you're talking about, because I don't know what I said. He goes, listen to me. And he goes, would you like to come out here and, you know, work with us?
As director of product marketing.
Well, right? There was no even discussion about, because remember, this is Apple. So I was at that point, you know, sort of like, you know, coming to my senses a little bit.
Further, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I, you know, put the brakes on and like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, yeah, I mean, it certainly could be interesting. And he goes, you know, I just wanted to, you know, I had to ask you two questions. Were you interested? And two, would you be willing to move out here? He goes, because the team is out here. He goes, you couldn't stay on the East Coast. I know you grew up there. You've lived there forever. But it would mean you're coming out here. And I get, well, I guess if, you know, right job, I don't, you know, see that as an issue. So he goes, okay, great. And I, one second, what's the job? He goes, well, it would be, you'll be reporting directly to Phil Schiller, Senior Vice President, Worldwide Marketing. And Phil wants to tell you about it directly. So I said, you're asking me if I'm interested in a job, if I'm willing to move out to the West Coast, but you're not willing to tell me what the job is. And he goes, yeah, that's pretty much it. Because Phil's going to give you a call in the next couple of days. I guess my wife, honey, you'll never guess what that was about. And
so you flew out?
No, I didn't fly out. So a couple of days goes by. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I hadn't heard from anyone. I was just figuring out, you know, it's one of those things, some things, you know, jobs come up or whatever. Then I get a call from one of the Apple's senior recruiters. And she says to me, goes, you know, Phil asked me to deal with this job rec directly. So I wanted to, you know, speak to you about it. And, you know, Phil would actually like to have you come out and talk to you about it directly. And I was sort of like, what's the job? Well, Phil wants to talk to you directly about that. I was like, okay.
Crazy.
She goes, can you come out? And I said, I'm sure I can find time to come out. And he goes, well, what about the day after tomorrow? Like, okay. ended up flying out, and as soon as I got off the plane, I got a text message from the recruiter saying one of the people I was supposed to meet the next day, Hiroki Asai, who worked for Phil's on Phil's staff and was in charge of marketing communications, was leaving to go to China or something the next day. So can you just meet with him like right away? Like, okay, I just got off the plane. I never met
her. You must have been on cloud nine at this point, right?
Yeah. I mean, so
it was flying all the way to San Jose, getting off the plane, getting text messages, starting meetings. It must have been crazy. Cool.
It was a little bit crazy, but it was also like, what on earth have I gotten myself into? So I met with Hiroki, and then the next day was a round of meetings with pretty much, it started with Phil and the rest of his staff. Was Phil, Jaws, Brian Kroll, who was in charge of macOS at the time, Dave Moody, who ran Macintosh, Michael Chow, who was in charge of iPad, Ron Okamoto, did developer relations.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty much the full gamut of Phil's team. And again, most of these people are people that I'd worked with one way or another.
It's a serious group of guys.
And yeah, I mean, it turned out that I was, you know, going to be reporting directly to Phil. I was going to be part of this team. The position was Senior Director Worldwide Product Marketing, reporting directly to Phil. And, you know, flew out. And the next day I got a call from the recruiter, and she said, you know, Phil thinks you're great. Team wants you. And, you know, when can you start working? And I said, huh? She goes, well, I'll have a formal offer for you in like a day or two. But, you
know, was there any intimation in this meeting about what the scope and details of your responsibilities would be? Or were you, or were they just kind of roping you in without talking about the details?
It was sort of a combination. Like a lot of things at Apple, things tend to evolve over time. I did have some fairly specific roles that I went out to do. I don't want to get into those because
of course.
I'm just not quite sure, you know, what's appropriate and sort of there's what happens at Apple tends to stay at Apple. You don't see a whole lot of Apple employees write books, you know, under their own name.
You know, my background was product marketing as well. I was started off as science and technology marketing, my first job. And it didn't turn out to be quite what I thought it was going to be in terms of marketing. Because when you think of marketing, you think of facing the public and talking and being press certified. And that's often not what marketing is about. Did you find that to be true?
Well, marketing at Apple was very different. My role was going to be very different. And, you know, you talk about disappearing. That's pretty much what it was like. You know, friends talk about it as my rendition period. Because, you know, one of the things that was said to me was, you know, you're used to being the guy in the room. You're used to be the person talking to the press. You're used to be, you know, this central figure all of yourself. And you have to understand, Apple speaks with one voice and you're not the voice.
And it's not product marketing. It's marketing communications.
Right. And, you know, so I did work with, you know, the folks in Marcom who were sort of orthogonal to Phil's organization. Mm-hmm. But it was really, you know, toiling right across the hall from Phil and, you know, working in obscurity and not tweeting because not so much because things were forbidden. It wasn't like there was a forbidden policy, but you didn't want to come out and say something that could look poorly on Apple. You didn't want to say something. You didn't want to get embroiled in, you know, controversies where you might have taken a side.
I can tell you a story in my own case about that. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
So it was the question of sublimating, and but it was really a great, you know, experience. And it really, you know, Apple is probably one of the best places in the world to work. I can't think of a better place personally. And, you know, working on Phil's team, being a part of that operation, seeing things kind of holistically where I was able to, you know, I had the fun of getting an overview of not just, you know, one product, but of every product, and how the things were coming to market and the role of marketing in all of these things, and the decisions and the things that go into, you know, creating a product, bringing it to market, creating, you know, the keynotes and the, and all of the marketing materials around it and the messaging, that needs to be done.
That's important because there's a whole lot of things that, like you say, that need to be done in the background that people don't think about when they think about the development of a product.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you get the sense, at least, you know, I used to get this feeling sometimes when I was sitting in the audience, you know, particularly in a Steve keynote, that, you know, you'd be sitting there and, you know, Steve had just finished some project in his garage, was driving up, you know, 101 in San Francisco, got on stage, just couldn't wait to tell everyone about it. And that's kind of what it felt like. And, you know, it felt that way, you know, with Tim and with Phil, that these things always had the sense of spontaneity that, you know, you knew weren't spontaneous. You knew that the product wasn't just finished, you know, yesterday, and, you know, magic, it's appearing. But that's the way it felt. And part of the fun on the marketing side was to make that magic happen. And, you know, to kind of work behind, you know, the curtain in Oz and, you know, do some great stuff and, you know, work with an incredible, incredible bunch of people.
Wicked, it is a smart, dizzying feeling.
I used to like walk into staff meetings and think, wow, I just dropped the average IQ in this room down by 50 points.
So was there anything about the job that you weren't expecting that sort of like you never would have thought I'd be doing this?
There were a lot of things I never thought I would be doing. It's sort of like when I started running back in the day and start realizing that you're using muscles that you didn't know you had. Mm-hmm. You find yourself doing things that you didn't know that you could do and you had to do. You know, and I think that's probably one of the most important things about Apple as an environment and as a culture is you're expected to know what to do. You're expected to know where to be. You're expected to know what someone else needs, when they need it, when something else needs to be prioritized. And it is a company, you know, we talk about the details, right? The details of a keynote, the details of a product, you know, a commercial, the details of a product, details of packaging. Well, guess what? This is a company that lives in details itself. I remember the first day I sent someone an email, and I think I still kept this somewhere printed out, and I got it back. And at the end of it, it said "P.S. Spelling counts here," and corrected a mistake. Yeah, I got the word "the" wrong. I typed "HDE," and it was flagged. Like, okay, this is going to be an interesting place to work. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was your job to make sure that your stuff was on time.
No pressure.
If your stuff was late, it wasn't any good. You weren't there. But if your stuff wasn't really excellent and it was on time, well, that didn't help anyone either. So there was this constant sense of making sure that speed and accuracy go hand in hand. There is no real margins for error. But on the other hand, it's because this is an environment where it's, if you're here, you're just expected to know how to do certain things.
So you did this for about 24 months or something like that.
Yeah, right? It's just under 3 years.
36 months.
Yeah, so I got to see, I think the first products that I got to work on were, I think it was the Apple, it was the iPhone 5S. And I saw everything through to the stuff that was introduced, including iPad Pro and the new Apple TV and, you know, watch. So it was really, I got to work on some really awesome, you know, projects, you know, the emergence of the 6, the new MacBook, the Mac Pro, you know, sure. Phil's famous "can't innovate my ass"
I'm
comment.
I'm talking to you on a Mac Pro.
Yeah, that's when we were getting slammed on the, you know, can't innovate anymore.
Right. But we got to be careful about the language that we used. If I may ask, and if you're willing, can you tell us what led to the parting of ways?
Well, it was almost 3 years. I went out, like I said, to do some very specific things, and it was a period of time when those things were being wrapped up. And I sat with Phil. We had a conversation toward the end of 2015, and it was really a question of, these things are done. They don't need to be done by me anymore. They now can be handed off to a lot of other, you know, junior people. They're things that can now just be, you know, continue to be done, but don't need to be started from scratch. And we spoke for a long time, and we both basically came to the same conclusion. I said, you know, I think I'd like to go back east. And, you know, he said, I can understand that. And, you know, can you stick around through the end of the year? And I was like, well, sure, to make sure things are entirely wrapped up. And then it didn't really make sense to stay beyond that or go much more beyond that, because at that point you're into a new set of product cycles. And once you're into a new set of product cycles, now you've got responsibilities. Now you have all sorts of other you know, things that are going on. You're not going to walk out in the middle. So it's really naturally good break point. But also I was just pretty tired. I had been working really long.
70-hour weeks are normal. Maybe more.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it sounds weird when you're on the outside, when someone like Tim gets up and says, you know, we're not in this for the money. We're here to make the world a better place. And our products are going to make the world a better place. And you hear people kind of snicker and go, yeah, you know, that's easy for Apple to say no, because you're a company that's going to be worth, you know, $1 trillion. But that's what people at Apple believe. And, you know, if you don't think that's correct, there's so many people at Apple who have been there long enough, they clearly don't have to be working anymore. They could probably just go out and buy an island and, you know, do whatever they want.
I imagine that's what Bertrand Soleil did. I imagine.
Yeah. You know, and I think there are people who basically say, I've done this a while. I've made my contribution. Now I want to either go do something else or I want to rest. There's a lot of people that are still working 70, 80, 90 hour weeks. So if you want to say, okay, people just want to work and they want to stay involved, they don't have to be working that hard. You don't work that hard because it's for the money. You're working because you believe in doing something great.
That's right. Making a dent in the universe.
It really is. And you know, Apple under Tim really reflects that. You know, one of the things Tim did was he brought back employee gift matching. So if you donated money to charity up to $10,000 a year, Apple was going to match it, your charity of choice. There was the big focus on Earth Day, hiring Lisa Jackson, who's the former head of the EPA, to come in and focus on these issues. It's hard to imagine another company doing this, or another company that is so focused on, you know, supplier issues and working to make the supply chain better, because it can, and therefore has a responsibility to do so. And this was just an underlying theme of Tim's leadership to the company, making this focus. But to do that, you really have to be extraordinarily passionate. And either I think you end up in that role where you are going to be working those hours for many, many years, or you hit the point that I did and said, this was great, but I'm going to leave while I'm not, you know, totally frazzled.
And now you're writing for iMore. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm writing for iMore as call it, I think it's on their analyst in residence. Renee, Richie and I had a long friendship going back. And when he heard that I was leaving Apple, I think he's one of the first people that kind of picked up on it. We had a conversation and said, you know, if you're looking to write and do stuff, you want to do it at iMore? And I said, absolutely. In fact, you're the first and you know, only folks that I'm talking to. And he said, great. So I left Apple in January, kind of wrapped things up, really took a few months off just to breathe, start relocating the family back east where my family was. So it was clear I was going to come back here. But I also just needed to, you know, kind of take a bit of a mental break, and I was fortunately able to do so, because it's sort of also like when you run a marathon, you need a cool down period. Sure. And so you work this incredible level of intensity. And I remember for weeks afterwards, I'd like, you know, get up and like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, like, well, what do I have to do today? And I realized, okay, I don't have to. And I know that was good when I left, when for at least a couple months I would have, you know, I don't say you can call dreams or nightmares of, you know, Phil or being in Phil's staff meeting or something like that. Like, huh? Okay. Yeah.
So folks, this is what it's like to work for Apple. So be careful what you want for. Be careful what you dream about.
it's great. It's great. I would do it again in a heartbeat. But, you know, like I said, there's a certain degree of you know, passion, mission that you're changing the world. And, you know, after 3 years for me, I still felt like I'm here to help us sell iPhones. I mean, they're great products, but I don't know if we're quite up there with, you know, polio vaccines, although we've done some incredibly amazing things. And like I said, Apple's just a really unique company. And we could spend, you know, hours talking about things like, you know, performance review and other companies and, you know, last forever. And I remember my first performance review with Phil. It was like booked on my calendar for 5 minutes. And I asked Jaws, like, what's going on here? Like, was 5 minutes? Is that a mistake? He goes, no. He goes, HR insists that Phil actually meet with people now in person. He goes, but don't take up more than 2 minutes of his time. He's going to be annoyed at you.
Well, as you said earlier in the show, if you're not doing well, you'll find out long before the performance review.
Exactly. And that was his response then. He goes, if you don't know how you're doing, you don't belong. If you need a performance review to tell you, you know, what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, you don't belong here. And, you know, if you can't pick up on those things, then you don't belong here. Right. So yeah, it was really sort of, you know, interesting. You know, I remember the review walked in, feels like, you know, here, how you doing? You know, good job. Glad you came. Here's a piece of paper. Now get out of here. go back to work.
Well, Michael, with that, we're starting to run out of time, and that's a great story. I wonder if maybe at some point in the future, I can have you back on the show to talk about Apple today and your perspectives about Apple, because of all the experience you have with Apple. So maybe we can do that sometime.
Yeah, no, that would be great, especially because I think the last of my proprietary knowledge is coming to an end as we're moving into future product cycles. Yeah,
I think the perspectives in general will be really valuable.
And things change. So yeah, we'd definitely love to do that. Happy to come on anytime.
Okay, so it's time to about wrap this up. I want to thank you so much. This has been a fascinating story. I'm sure the listeners will be interested and enjoy hearing this story about your experience with Apple. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish to.
Sure. Follow me on Twitter at Gartenberg, GARTENBERG. You can also just check out my website. It's michaelgartenberg.com. And if you want to send me email, it's m@michaelgartenberg.com.
Cool. This has been an excellent discussion. Thank you so much for being on the show. What a great story. So, folks, thanks for coming by and thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Mac Observer's Background Mode.